passed an incredible hurdle in my life by telling all the kids about my issues. I think I am about ready to transition. There is only one problem. How am I going to do this without being subjected to even more worldwide ridicule than I already have been? The idea of a man becoming a woman is still shocking and weird to people, ghoulishly funny. There is no place to hide. I could move to the Sahara, and the paparazzi and the tabloids would find me. It wouldn't become a serious story, but a tabloid one. Jenner found alive in dress. It is too important a story, not just for me, but for the trans community, to land in the gutter. It's been in the gutter since the 1980s. I am not going to let it stay there. There is only one solution. Better call Nirob. I have not worked with Alan at Rogers and Cowan for a quarter of a century. I haven't spoken to him, and I'm not even sure he still works there. He was a cub when he handled me in the 1980s, helping me through the storm of the New York Times when the rumors were rife. I knew through the grapevine that he had become one of the top public relations executives in Hollywood. He knows everyone and is highly regarded for his no-bullshit approach, not one of these people who only tell you what you want to hear. I assume he has branched out to his own firm. But just for the hell of it, I call directory assistance for Rogers and Cowan in Beverly Hills. Then I dial the number. A receptionist answers.
Can I help you?
Alan Nirob.
1 second, please.
My God, he still works there. Hello? Alan, it's Bruce Jenner. His first instinct is to make sure I am okay, that the mainstream media is not looking to do a story that will blow up my life. Are you all right? I'm fine. That's good. I bet you've been waiting for this call for the last 30 years. No, not really. It's good to know that he hasn't changed a drop. Alan, you gotta come out this weekend. We have to sit down and talk. We make a date. I sit him down in the exact same chair as Pastor Brad. It's my lucky chair. He already knows my story and gender issues, so I don't have to recite them again. There is one new wrinkle since we spoke about it in the 1980s. I think I am truly ready to transition and would like to do it without being inserted into the media meat cleaver. It is also a story that needs context, as much about the transgender community and the problems it faces as about me. How the hell can we pull this off? It cannot be something that's in the gutter because it's there right now with the tabloids. We have to find the right people who can tell this story with compassion. Alan immediately mentions Diane Sawyer because of her reputation on sensitive stories. Fair and firm, but no pulling of punches and end-arounds. He, of course, knows her and her producer, Mark Robertson. We move on to print. Alan asks me point blank, what would be your ideal dream choice in print? Vanity Fair. It is a highly credible news source. It does detailed profiles and is celebrity-driven. It's also edgy and likes to push the envelope a little bit. Wanting Diane Sawyer and Vanity Fair are fine. Just about everybody wants them when they think they have a story to tell. But actually getting them interested. How are we going to do this? Let's see if I can deliver. Alan issues only one caveat. I can't effectively do this by committee. It's me and you. Alan is aware I have 10 children, none of whom shrink when it comes to opinion. I'm in. Mark Robertson flies out to Los Angeles the following week to meet me. Brandon is there. So is Alan. So is Rhonda, whose competence and loyalty and friendship have been unlike those in any relationship I have ever had. All of them are protective of me, which makes me feel better. They are also aware of my propensity to say yes just to please someone. Robertson is a straight shooter. Nor does he need much convincing that this is a legitimate and worthy story. I would love to do this. His sense is that Diane will jump at it as well. But she is on sabbatical, In the space of several weeks, her husband, Mike Nichols, and her mother have died. The tragedy is incomprehensible. When Robertson goes to her apartment and approaches her in New York about the idea, she is still understandably shaken by all the losses she had to face so quickly. Robertson realizes that this simply isn't a good time. He comes back the next day and tells Diane about me and my readiness to talk openly. Diane does not hesitate. She wants to do it. She thinks it is a worthy story that will help people and make a difference. It will also be her first piece coming back to work, give her something to dive into, and help take her mind off the tragedies she has experienced. As for Vanity Fair, editor Graydon Carter already broached the idea of getting my cooperation for a story, given all the rumors. Alan does not know that. He independently approaches Jane Sarkin at Vanity Fair. She is the features editor of the magazine and has known Alan for close to 30 years. She has handled a slew of sensitive Vanity Fair cover stories and photographs, and also has a very close relationship with the photographer Annie Leibovitz. Alan trusts Jane. Jane trusts Alan. He knows she will make sure the story is handled fairly and with sensitivity. She knows that when Alan promises something, in this case, complete access to me for several months, he will not insist on a million conditions. Alan has a private conversation with Jane in early 2015. Roughly 2 days later, he calls me. "Okay, you got the cover of Vanity Fair." Holy crap, are you kidding me? I am doing this. The magazine chooses contributing editor Buzz Bissinger to write the story. I am familiar with the book he wrote about high school football in Texas, Friday Night Lights. Alan vets Buzz with an old friend he grew up with in Los Angeles, Fred Mann, an editor at the Philadelphia Inquirer when Buzz worked there. Mann says he is firm and prickly, can be tough, but is also fair. Alan has also read some of Buzz's other work, a book he wrote about his brain-injured son called Father's Day, and an intriguingly bizarre piece for GQ about his extreme leather fetish. He fits all the criteria, writing about sports, parenting, and perhaps most important of all, what it is like to be different. The pieces are in place, but this is an undeniably big story. Not just for the public, but for me. Bigger for me. How my transition will be perceived will be contingent on how I am portrayed. Diane Sawyer will go first in an exclusive interview on ABC's 2020, set to air on April 24, 2015. I will tell her I am transitioning. In fact, I already have when the piece runs, since the actual interview was in February. This is about Bruce's struggle, what he has been dealing with all his life. So Caitlin will not appear, nor will her name be mentioned. Roughly 2 months later, Vanity Fair will reveal my name for the first time on the cover, along with an Annie Leibovitz portrait. Alan is determined that we own the story and tell it the way we want to tell it. He doesn't want a complete circus. The way he sees it, the 2020 interview is saying goodbye to Bruce, and Vanity Fair is saying hello to Caitlin. I am very nervous when Diane comes to the beachfront home in Malibu to interview me. The segment is scheduled for 1 hour, but after Diane interviews me for 5 hours, she goes to her bosses and says the segment now needs to be 2 hours. I trust her totally. Often, journalists are preoccupied with questions about genitalia instead of the bigger, more pertinent issues at hand. When Orange is the New Black actress Laverne Cox, who set a landmark for the transgender community with her recurring role on the show, was asked about her genitalia, she gave the perfect answer. The preoccupation with transition and surgery objectifies trans people. And then we don't get to really deal with the real lived experiences. Just because you are a trans woman or man, why does the media think such a question is okay? Just because you are a trans person, it doesn't mean you have to answer every question. The implication of it is obvious. You're not the real thing unless you have had gender-affirming surgery. It is beyond malarkey. You don't have to do a single thing physically to be a trans man or woman. There is no rule book. To trans women and men, such a question is the equivalent of asking a cisgender man how his ejaculation went today, or a cisgender woman how her period is going. In other words, it's inappropriate and offensive unless a trans woman or man brings it up on their own. Sadly, it is the thing the public is preoccupied with the most, and you feel pinned into a corner and have no choice but to answer it once so there will be no more speculation. Which there will be anyway. No matter how sensitive Diane is when she interviews me, and how well-versed she is on the issues facing transgender men and women, what if I say the wrong thing? What if people simply think me perverse or inauthentic, or think I am doing it for money? I could have sold my story to the tabloids for millions if I was doing it for money. Or fame beyond the role of befuddlement I have on Keeping Up with the Kardashians. What if I inadvertently insult the transgender community because I still know very little about it? There is no second chance here. Because the interview is not airing live, I will be given the opportunity to reword something if, upon reflection, I regret saying it. Standard operating procedure in interviews of this nature. Both Diane and Mark are reassuring. This is your story, not ours. But no matter how many times I want to reword something, I obviously will not see the segment beforehand. Plenty of reporters have promised pure intentions and then beaten the hell out of me. As much as I trust Diane and Mark, I am not naive. They can still crucify me. Alan better be right. Between the tracheal shave and my pending divorce from Chris, the paparazzi are more relentless than ever. I live in a gated community, and any time I leave, there are 4 or 5 waiting outside to take pictures and often follow. They are resourceful, but so am I. Because I was once a race car driver, I am pretty skilled at making stealth lefts and stealth rights and U-turns. So instead of the paparazzi following me, I am following them. There are few better feelings than watching one look into his rearview mirror and then turn around so I can wave because I am trailing behind. Sometimes they get so confused that they wait by the side of the road to reorient themselves when I drive by. That merits a nice wave as well. On one occasion, after they chase me into the driveway of Brandon's house, I manage to block them in with my car and call the police. The most amazing part is the offended look on their faces, as if I haven't played fair. I don't go many places, mostly to a nearby Starbucks on the Pacific Coast Highway to get my grande vanilla latte fix. I wear a baggy sweatshirt with a hood pulled over my head so they can barely see my face. I also wear the same outfit every day on the assumption that they are getting the same picture all the time and no outlet will want to buy it. The customers at Starbucks know me pretty well, and sometimes when there is a photographer lurking in the parking lot, they form a protective shield around me and escort me to my car. They don't like that. They will regroup and redraw battle lines and retaliate. The nail offensive. Several months before the 2020 interview and the Vanity Fair cover, I start having girls' nights. They are informal gatherings at my house and a way of introducing the woman I will call Caitlin to close family and friends. There is no way I am going to host a girls' night without getting my nails done. It would be like Kim showing up at a public event in flannel pajamas. But I can't go to a manicurist. So I go to Sherwood to play golf, then sit in my car in a mostly empty parking lot afterward painting my nails, then let them dry as I drive the half hour to my home. I put one of my hands out the window so they can dry a little more quickly and I won't have to fuss with them when I get home. I am at a stoplight. My hand is raised just enough so it is visible. Zzz, Z z z. A photographer has been following me ever since I left the golf club. He is across the street, going in the opposite direction.
Z-z-z-z-z.
It's all over the tabloids the next day and for weeks afterward. The Painted Lady. All because I raised my hand 6 inches too high in my car, stopped at a light. Okay, you got me on this one. Never again. I start wearing work gloves whenever I drive. It is impossible for my children or my mother and sisters to walk through the grocery line and not see the picture plastered on the rags. It makes me look like a fool and is extraordinarily painful to my family. And all of this is before the Diane Sawyer interview airs. What will it be like after I tell my story and publicly announce my intent to transition in front of millions? In the weeks before the air date, I go through my Rolodex and call people I am close to, or once was close to before I drifted away, to tell them what is happening. I call my sister Pam. Since she has known of my issues for a long time, I doubt she will be very surprised. What does surprise me is her reaction. She tells me not to do it because she is worried I will be labeled a freak. Then she talks about what her friends will think. I was always proud of the fact of being Bruce Jenner's sister. Eventually people find out. I watched the Olympics. What a hero he was. I was very proud of that, and now, oh my God, how is this going to come across? I have to be honest. I really am not worried about what Pam's friends will think. I am worried about surviving all of this. But I now realize her reaction was really one of being scared, not just for her, but also for me. Now comes the most difficult moment of all. Because my mom is so sharp at the age of 88 and still lives on her own and still drives a Cadillac, even though she can barely see over the dashboard, she knows that her son has been in the news. A few weeks earlier, she had called me to ask what was going on. The tabloid magazines are tearing you apart and saying things that I didn't know about you wearing nail polish and that business when you went to the doctor and had a bandage. I can't help but see it every time I go to the grocery store. And if someone is writing about you, I am going to read it. I don't buy it. I go down the aisle and read it and then put it back because I don't want to contribute financially to those people. But what is going on? I still deny everything. I just blame it on tabloid journalism, and that seems to satisfy her. My mom is a person of faith and goes regularly to church. I wonder how that part of her life will be able to deal with this. But at the end of the conversation, she says something that gives me great hope. I don't care if it's true or false. I loved you the day you were born, and I'll never stop. I can't put it off any longer. I dial my mother's number. Mom, are you sitting down? She is sitting in a tall chair at the island in the kitchen, having her coffee. Yes, dear, I'm sitting down. I've got something to tell you. Okay. You know how you've been reading all these stories about me, and actually I've been denying them and blaming it on the tabloids, but it's about time I talk to you about this. Actually, there is a lot of truth to them. A pause. Ever since I was very little, I have suffered from gender dysphoria. I have always had this woman that has lived inside me, and it's made my life very difficult. I've had to deal with a lot of things that you didn't know throughout the years. I wasn't honest with you. I wasn't honest with anybody. But that Diane Sawyer interview is going to come up and you're going to hear a lot of things that you probably didn't know about me, but it's going to be okay. A pause. Now it's my mom's turn to say something. Why didn't I know? What could I have done? You were in pain. This is my fault. Mom, it had nothing to do with you. This is just kind of the way I am made. Well, I could have done better. Why didn't I see this? We talk several more times in the days that follow. She still feels guilt in not having detected anything as I was growing up and helping to alleviate it. But typical of my mom, she begins to copiously read about the issue of gender dysphoria on the internet. The more we talk about the issues, the better she feels and the better I feel. She is relieved to finally get an answer to why I held myself at arm's length when I was growing up, how there had always been a subtle discomfort. She realizes that none of this had anything to do with the way I was brought up. With each conversation, our relationship, never a perfect line, draws closer and closer. Of course, she's my mom, so she still worries. She braces herself for what will happen when I go public on television. She is not the only one. Chapter 13. The Looking Glass. I watch the segment at the home in Hidden Hills where Chris and I once lived together. It is ABC's East Coast feed, so it begins at 6 p.m. All the Kardashian kids are there, with the exception of Robert. Kendall and Kylie are on opposite sides of me on a couch in the living room. Chris is behind us in a chair by herself. How shocked or not she is by my transition is immaterial at this moment. It has to be very, very weird to see your former husband of 23 years and with whom you have two children go on television in front of an estimated 17.1 million people and say, "For all intents and purposes, I am a woman." Wow. I can't believe I just said that. I am a woman. Do you know how incredible that sounds from my lips? How I never ever thought those words would come except in moments of privacy with a handful of others? How I was convinced I would die with a life that was incomplete? I am a woman. The secret is out after 65 years. I am a woman. Say it again to the heavens so God can hear it and smile. I am a woman. Jesus, Jenner, what took you so long? Kendall and Kylie, who between them have close to 200 million followers on Instagram and Twitter, the couch collectively has close to 500 million, start hitting the social media channels almost immediately after the interview has begun. Their sisters join in. Here it comes. Kendall gives the initial results. Dad, you should see the reaction you were already getting. It's incredible. It is a great moment. But frankly, I am worried about logistics. I go over to Casey's house in Santa Monica and make it in time to watch the West Coast feed at 9 p.m. All the Jenner kids are there and their spouses and significant others, as well as Christy and Linda. They, too, are elated with how the segment went. Everybody in the three families is happy. At least for a day. Several of the Jenner children were interviewed during the show, as were my mother and sister. The Kardashian side feels slighted by their noticeable absence. They are right to feel slighted. They were slighted on purpose because of research showing that any time a Kardashian is on television, many in the public tend to think it is a publicity stunt to make money. I love my kids, and the last thing on earth I ever want to do is somehow think I am rejecting them. But because of the research, I needed to build a wall and distance myself for this interview. It was too important. After all of the time it took to get here, I needed to make clear that this is real. This is my life and not some publicity stunt. I couldn't afford to add any fuel to the rumor that I was only doing it for money. I only had one chance. This had to be about me and only me. If I screwed up, at least it would be on my own terms. Much to my relief, the public reaction is phenomenal. My honesty and sincerity have come through, no doubt because I have one great advantage. I only know how to be candid, regardless of repercussion. The level of interest was amazing as well. The show had the highest ratings for the news magazine in more than 15 years, and the highest-rated non-sports network show on a Friday night in 12 years. I have made it through whole. I am still in one piece. But I'm not quite done yet. Wait until they see Caitlin for the first time. Everybody has advice about what I should wear for the Vanity Fair photo shoot. The older Jenner children really want me to tone it down, elegant but not too flashy or revealing. Their intentions are good. They want me to set the right tone of womanhood as they define it. They are also sincerely worried that the more glam I try to be, the more I will feed the accusations of exploitation. They are trying to protect me. But their vision of womanhood is not my vision of womanhood. The most resonant advice comes from Kim, who, as she points out, doesn't simply know fashion, but is fashion. You gotta rock it. Before the actual Vanity Fair shoot, we need to go back in time a little bit, because there is an actual date, a literal moment when Bruce takes a final bow and Caitlin steps onto the stage. March 15, 2015. Several days earlier, I had played golf by myself one final time at Sherwood, hitting 3 balls on each hole before I quit after the 7th and eat a steak sandwich in the dim womb of the clubhouse. I sit lonely in my house one final time watching television. I am in my cocoon of isolation one final time. Or am I? Will the comfort I hope to feel as a woman only lead to discomfort in others? Will people look at me and say privately to themselves, "My God, what have you done to yourself?" Will I think the same thing? What have I done to myself? I do not feel scared. I feel confident that this is the right thing to do. I am excited. But when you have surgery such as this, there is no turning back. There is no, "Oops, I made a mistake, just put everything back the way it was." The questions are daunting. The answers even more so. I leave the house in Malibu at 4:15 a.m. Rhonda is once again driving. The appointment is not until 6 a.m. at a surgical center in Beverly Hills, but I hate being late for anything. Plus, I doubt that the paparazzi are up at this early hour hoping to snap my picture. We take the Pacific Coast Highway to I-10 East to I-105 North, and then into Beverly Hills. Rhonda, who knows my moods better than anyone, can tell that I am nervous. Sometimes small talk can often lessen those feelings, but not now. I just want to get this over with. I am tired thinking about it. Pioneered in the 1980s and 1990s by San Francisco plastic surgeon Douglas Ousterhout, facial feminization surgery involves hairline correction, forehead contouring, and jaw and chin contouring. I will also have a procedure to augment my breasts. For me, and speaking only for me, the feeling is that if I'm going to do it, then I might as well do it. Every trans woman or man has her or his definition of authenticity. I want to look as physically a woman as I possibly can, based on my own image. I will never feel like a woman if I don't have the surgery. I also have the luxury of being able to afford such an extensive procedure. It is not something I suddenly thought I should have. One way or another, I have thought about altering my appearance for almost 50 years. I have chosen the facial plastic surgeon Harrison Lee, who has offices in Beverly Hills and New York, and is one of the best surgeons of this type in the country. The actual procedure will be in the Beverly Hills offices of Gary Alter, who has equally impeccable credentials and will do the breast augmentation. The Los Angeles Marathon is being held on the same day, so we carefully map out the route to avoid street closures. We arrive at 5 a.m. before the sun is even up, Another component of the cat-and-mouse game that is my life. Always try to get there when it's still dark out. By prearrangement, we drive into an alley behind the clinic where the surgery will take place. A nurse is there to meet us, and it's only a matter of 3 or 4 steps before I am in the office. I now have 3 security officers scanning every nook and cranny. Lee has thoroughly gone over all the steps of the procedure well beforehand. I think it will take maybe 5 hours. It takes around 10. Not that I remember anything since I am out cold from anesthesia. I hate surgeries. I hate going under the knife. I hate getting knocked out. I hate waking up groggy and disoriented and dizzy. I am under for about 12 hours before I wake up at roughly 7 p.m. Security personnel are now roaming the halls of the office looking for paparazzi. They help me through the back door into a waiting black van. My head is spinning during the entirety of the hour and a half ride back to Malibu. I am lying down in a corner of the van, dozing in and out, and it seems like it is taking forever when all I want to do is get home. My face is fully bandaged, so I can barely see. My breasts are bandaged as well. In normal circumstances, I would spend the night in the hospital in case of complications. But these are not normal circumstances, and the risk of discovery too great, since hospitals are notorious celebrity cesspools for leaks. So Dr. Lee comes home with me, and so does a nurse. They spend the night along with Rhonda. It becomes perhaps the most difficult night of my life. I want to fully wake up, but I can't, because I was out for so long. I keep trying to get my senses about me. Wake up! That's all I keep thinking. Wake up! But when I close my eyes, my head is still spinning, and I can feel the drugs coursing through my body, and this is now several hours after the surgery. I shut my eyes, and I finally think I'm getting some sleep. Then I open them and look at the clock next to my bed, and only 2 minutes have gone by. I try again. 2 minutes. Again. 2 minutes. Again. This time it's not even close to 2 minutes. My eyes shoot open. My heartbeat becomes so loud I can hear it. Ka-thump, ka-thump, ka-thump. My adrenal glands are pumping. This has never happened to me before. I am always in control of my emotions, but not tonight. Get a grip. Just get a grip. Try to take a deep breath. In. Out. Another. In. Out. It's not working. I am having a panic attack. Every question that I had before the surgery hits me again, only this time like a stream of bullets. Without embellishing, and I swear I am not embellishing, it is like I am convulsing inside. What the fuck did you just do? What the fuck did you just do? Stop it. Just stop it. I can't. What the fuck did you just do? Louder inside my head. What the fuck did you just do? The cold dread of fear. The public may have been accepting of me in the 2020 piece, but I was still Bruce when the cameras rolled. They haven't seen me with my face altered and augmented breasts. I haven't seen me. What if I look in the mirror for the first time and see a complete stranger? Who is this person? What if I look in the mirror and hate the way I look, just like I did before? What if I regret this? Oh, God. Please, God. Don't desert me now. Don't do it. The nurse is right beside me in the room. I put my feet down on the floor. Turn on the TV. I need distractions, noise, anything. I can't go where my head is going right now. Just the noise. Please, just the noise. That will help. I know it will help. It doesn't. I walk out of the bedroom and start pacing in the adjacent hallway. That will help get this out of me. I know it will. It doesn't. The questions are flying fast and furious now, one after another, with no space in between. How am I going to be accepted? How are my kids going to accept me? Are you going to be considered a freak from this point on? Here you were the big, big jock Bruce Jenner, and now all of a sudden you're not. You're not, not even close to that. What is my mother going to think? What is my sister going to think? What am I going to think? I will pace all night if I have to. I'm not shutting my eyes again. The questions die down a little bit. The panic turns into something a little bit softer and easier to manage. It isn't questions that fill my head now, but another thought entirely. It can't be worse than the other side where I came from. The thought builds, and now there is a slice of comfort. I can make this work. I will make it work. I am going to live authentically for the first time in my life. I am going to learn every single issue facing the brothers and sisters of the transgender community. I am going to raise money. I am going to start a foundation. I am going to use my public platform to tirelessly speak on the issues. I am going to have an enthusiasm for life that I have not had in 39 years since the Olympics, almost two-thirds of my life. I will make a difference because I am different. The pacing back and forth helps. The panic attack subsides. It never comes back again. The only problem now is that I look like hell, as if my face was thrown in the dryer on high heat and then ironed. It is not a pretty sight, and the fear is that I am going to end up looking like Michael Jackson. But after roughly 6 weeks, the swelling has gone down and almost all the scars have disappeared. I look like, well, who do I look like? You try picking out a permanent new name for yourself after 65 years. It's weird. I had thought of names as far back as Graceland. There was a singing group at college called the Serendipity Singers, and one of their numbers was a song called Heather. I thought Heather might be a cool name because the song was so cool. But after college, the name faded away. I thought about something simple, like Mary. Then, when Chris and I got together, I felt obligated to pick a name that began with K, which is when Kathy popped into my head. But Kathy seemed like, well, Kathy. So one of my favorite pastimes became watching the Miss Universe and Miss America pageants with pen and paper in hand to jot down the names of all the different contestants. I was hoping there was one I particularly liked whose name I would also like. But I struck out and never did settle on one that seemed just right. Until I became a woman. Now I really did need to find a name for the rest of my life. I went back to Heather, but I really wasn't crazy about it. I talked to Rhonda about the naming dilemma, how whenever I thought I had found one that works, I ended up getting bored with it after a while. Rhonda made her own suggestion. I've always liked the name Caitlin. I had thought about Caitlin back in the K period, which meant it would have been spelled Caitlin with a K. However it was spelled, there was no way I was going to have a name now that began with a K. That would have been beyond creepy. Which is when Rhonda chimed in again. I always liked the spelling of C-A-I-T-L-Y-N. So Caitlin it will be. I choose the middle name Marie simply because I like it. I leave the last name Jenner intact, even though at a certain point I had thought of changing it to get away from my past life as much as possible. I am glad I didn't. Caitlin. Caitlin Marie. Caitlin Marie Jenner. I can get used to that. But I am not sure everyone is totally happy with it. I was with Kim one day when she asked me, "Well, what are we going to call you?" "It's Caitlin." "You stuck with the K's, huh?" "I'm spelling it with a C." "Oh, I'm kind of disappointed." Spoken like a true Kardashian. So now that I have a name, what's left? The final hurdle, when all I do is tell the world who I now am and show them what I now look like. Several weeks before the shoot, Annie Leibovitz comes out to the house to scout the site and get to know me a little better. Vanity Fair's fashion and style director Jessica Diehl flies out from New York to meet with me as well and find out what I like and what I don't, or more accurately, what I shouldn't wear, tactfully steering me away from the big fashion statement in favor of a mix of what she describes as Rene Russo in the Thomas Crown Affair meets Angelina Jolie, elegant with a dash of tough. The day before the shoot, she and her assistant Ryan Young return for a fitting. I had always fantasized about having beautiful clothes that fit. As many times as I had stood in front of hotel mirrors and thought I looked good, I always knew it could be better. Just as I also had convinced myself I would never get the opportunity. So now, some apparel has been shipped previously. Other items were brought by Diehl and Young on the flight to Los Angeles. There are well over 100 different pieces, gowns, blouses, sweaters, belts, cocktail dresses, lingerie, jewelry, heels, high heels. So many items that a temporary tent is built on my sizable deck. What is perhaps most amazing of all is that none of the haute couture shops where Diehl and Young searched for clothing in New York asked who exactly these items were for, given the person was 6'2". Diehl thinks it's because I have the look of a 1980s Amazonian model with a slender frame, which is what I may want carved on my tombstone, along with a quote from Diehl saying I look perfect in Tom Ford. I have trouble initially believing that this is all for me to try on, the only goal being to make me look my best. 90% of the clothing fits. It is the first time I have ever openly worn women's clothing in front of a group of strangers. It is so easy, so natural, so effortless, so fun, the way my life was always supposed to be. Annie comes to the house the next day to take the pictures for the magazine cover, arriving with a caravan of assistants to rival that of Genghis Khan. Several editors from the magazine are here, including Jane Sarkin. So is Dana Brown, the editor on the 11,000-word piece by Buzz that will be published in several weeks in the July issue that actually comes out in early June. I have no idea why magazines do it this way. Jessica Diehl is obviously still here to make sure that the outfits Annie ultimately chooses for the shoot will fit perfectly. There are also two professional stylists for hair and makeup. Are you kidding me? Security is airtight, so news of the photo shoot will not leak. Those attending must leave their cars in the parking lot at Zuma Beach in Malibu. They are picked up by a nondescript white van driven by a member of the security detail and then transported up a winding road to the driveway of my house. Once there, they are required to turn in their cell phones, after which they will be escorted inside. I have already had a temporary wall built around my house to block out the paparazzi, who over the past several weeks have taken photos from roughly a mile across the canyon using super telephoto lenses. The shoot lasts for 2 days. Annie Leibovitz is Annie Leibovitz after all. She has a clear vision of how she wants me to look. A little bit 40s Hepburn, a little bit Vargas girl, glamorous and beautiful and a touch of sexy. The photo of me that is chosen for the cover, posing in a cream-colored bustier with perfect makeup and hair and a headline that simply says, "Call me Caitlin," will become instantly iconic. It is the photograph that everyone will remember me by. But the pose I remember the most takes place in the garage of my house, which has been converted into a studio. All the junk that has accumulated over the years, including the accordion, has temporarily disappeared. I am wearing an off-the-shoulder black gown by Zach Posen. It is killer, if I do say so myself. All the lights in the garage have been turned off, leaving only the ones set up for the shoot. There is dark everywhere else except on me, a kind of spotlight effect. There is a large mirror. Annie tells one of her assistants to move it behind the camera so I can actually see myself. Not every day of my life will be spent with hair and makeup and beautiful clothing hand-picked by a stylist with Annie Leibovitz taking my photograph. It is safe to say that no day of my life will ever be spent this way again. But in that moment, when I look into the mirror, I truly see myself for the first time. So many other times I had looked into the mirror with familiar loathing and disgust. But now the view from the looking glass is different. I see who I am. I am who I know. I know who I am. I am Caitlin. Caitlin Marie Jenner. Forever Forward. September 17, 2016. I am ready to seize the day. We're waiting for the moon to rise over Malibu. It is a perfect night atop the ridge of Decker Canyon. No fog rolling in from the Pacific Ocean. No cloud formation spreading darkness through the Santa Monica Mountains. The temperature is in the 70s, and the usual wind has simmered down to a refreshing breeze. It is good to be home. I am hosting an after Labor Day cocktail party on the back patio, something I did not do a lot of back in the Bruce era. Actually, I don't think I ever did it at all. Some of the guests are old friends who supported me in my most difficult days in the late 1980s. Some are new friends I have made, trans women who have become soul sisters, members of the gay and lesbian community, and straights. Together, they form a rainbow from the worst period to my happiest one. Perhaps the best proof of how far I have come, I like being around people now. I want to be around people now. I like parties, when for 65 years of my life I hated them because I felt socially awkward and insecure. I like them now because I am comfortable with myself. Comfortable. Not a particularly complex word, yet a feeling so difficult for too many of us to attain because of all the roadblocks. I am Caitlin. I am a woman. What does that mean to be a woman now that I have been one for 18 months? How should I know? You can't learn how to be a woman. A woman has been inside me all my life, and I just have to let her live. There is no guide or checklist except those meaningless stereotypes. Each of us is distinct and different, so self-evident yet so difficult for so many people to accept or embrace. We all have choices. We all make choices. We should be allowed to make them without threat. It is why I have written this book, so that you see through my life the pain and compromises and inevitable unhappiness that accompany you wherever you go when you cannot make those choices, even though they are embedded in your soul. I have written this book to help us see that there is no right way to be, or wrong way to be, or any way to be except who you are. I have written this book to show all the obstacles to equal rights that exist in the community that I love and am so proudly a part of, the transgender community. I have written this book because I am lucky to have a public platform and want to use it. I have written this book because there is a way out, no matter how long it takes. There is no magic wand. There is no sprinkling of fairy dust and poof, you're completely different. When I became Caitlin in March 2015, I didn't wake up and immediately have an urge to cook and clean or sew or do any of the other tasks that women are still assumed to do in a society still dominated by men. Nor, for that matter, did I run to the bookstore and buy books by such landmark feminists as Betty Friedan and Gloria Steinem. All I can say is that I am evolving. Gender is a journey whoever you are. Thoughts change, circumstances change, your view of what is important changes, the world changes. It is easier for me to show emotions now, although it will never be easy. I feel so much more connected to the world now. I get up in the morning and get out of bed and look in the mirror, and everything is in kind of the right spot. Well, almost everything. I put on the clothes I want to put on without the perpetual fear that someone will see me or discover me. I go out and do the things I want to do without assuming a mask. My life is so much simpler now. No more 1,000 steps for a sliver of authenticity. I am ready to seize the day, learn something, get something done, after so many years in which I just wanted the day to end. I can talk to women now instead of being envious of them or removed from them because of fear of discovery or just feeling like I never fit in, because up until I transitioned, I never did. Hell, I don't even golf alone anymore. One of the best times of the week is Tuesday, when I play at Sherwood in a women's foursome, where we gab and laugh and trade style tips, and I outdrive them by 150 yards, and they still like me. In a men's foursome, I would hear the grumblings of competitive jealousy all the way into the next county. There is the inevitable and cosmic question of what it all means now, besides the option of hitting off the women's tee if I feel like it. It is a little presumptuous to answer. I still have enough trouble figuring out what to wear in the morning, but I also feel I should try given my lengthy journey. Appreciation, beauty, freedom, joy, liberation, love, simplicity, and, of course, comfort. There are many more descriptive words. I don't want to double the length of the book, but maybe it all boils down to this. Please, I am begging you, don't ever let your life succumb to what others think. Do not give in to fear, as I did for so many years. Do what is in your heart and soul. I guarantee you will never, ever regret it. Instead, you will have the very opposite, not an imagined life, but a life of new possibility, a true life. The more we celebrate our difference, the more we will be celebrated. There are too many of us out there anyway, just waiting to bloom and blossom. The status quo of society will just have to get used to us. Not everything is perfect. It is foolish to think that everything will be. I am still trying to sort out my relationship with all my children. I thought transition would draw us closer. Initially it did. But over the past several months there has been a void, a distance, with many of them. Sometimes as parents we aren't always aware of how unavailable we are in the best circumstances. Then as we grow older we have that feeling of wanting to be with our children when they can't because of their own full and busy lives. It is a circle of life where they can't always be there. It seems like they are doing the same thing we wish we hadn't done, but it's part of human nature and our own foibles. I want them to be more attentive, but how attentive was I when some of them were growing up? But I worry that my transitioning has been harder for them to cope with than they have let on, because in public their support for me has been stirring. But perhaps there is private embarrassment. Perhaps it is weird to call me Dad when I don't look like Dad. I know that Bert and Brandon and Brody did not like the Vanity Fair cover, not only because they thought it was too risque, but because I did not gauge how a son would feel seeing his father in a cream-colored bustier. Fair enough. Perhaps there are aspects of Caitlin they hoped would be different. Although I feel much more empathy on the inside, I still have trouble showing it on the outside. Although I am observant of others, I still talk about myself too much. Maybe some of the kids feel I spend too much time over the way I look, an admittedly radical departure from Bruce, who never worried about the way he looked. I am aware that in the newness of being a trans woman, there is a tendency to have an initial period of pseudo-adolescence, in which makeup and clothing become your touchstones of discovery, a way of feeling liberated. So maybe that will change. I wonder if I should sit down with the kids individually, just as I did before transition, so each can talk candidly with me, and I can talk candidly with them. Just as gender is a journey, so is the relationship you have with your children after you transition. Nothing comes instantly or overnight. There is no perfect. I know what it is like to be lonely. I was lonely for most of my life. My greatest fear now is that I will one day revert to that same kind of loneliness, a prisoner of my house, when the big difference now is that I don't want to be a prisoner. I am scared of becoming a hermit again, probably because past so often is prologue, at a time in my life when Caitlin sees the possibilities of the world that Bruce never saw. I still spend many nights alone. I still fear that I will be a loner even though I no longer want to be one. Maybe it is just ingrained into my soul like my womanhood. Just as core beliefs don't change, maybe certain traits of personality don't either. But I am going to give it a hell of a try to break the habit. Caitlin is too much damn fun. Bruce fundamentally disappeared the last 10 years of his life. Plus, talking about the Olympics does get old, very old. 2 days of my life lasted for more than 30 years. There is so much more. All the attention I have gotten over the past 18 months has been fun and wonderful. But attention inevitably fades. That's okay. It is family that sustains you, not attention from people you don't even know. As I do get older, I become more vulnerable. I face my mortality, and I don't want to face it alone. My mom worries about me becoming lonely again. She thinks it would be nice for me to find a companion. So there you have it. If the problems facing the LGBTQ community in the United States are formidable, they are 100 times more severe in Africa. Homosexuality is outlawed in 38 African nations. Any trans woman or man who appears in public and is identified as such faces the real risk of being severely beaten or killed. At minimum, arrest by authorities is a virtual given. I would like to go to Africa, although I know that my presence in many places would not be welcome. But it would draw attention, always the first step in overturning horrible conditions. But I will never stop fighting on behalf of the trans community here. I love America. I am proud of America. Whatever political views I have, they will never interfere with doing everything I can to help a community that has been so unfairly maligned and marginalized. I will talk with anyone at any time about the issues of job discrimination and teen suicide and violence. If I can move the needle an inch, then I have moved something. Then there is the issue of the final surgery. It is a complex decision under any circumstance, only made more complex because of the inherent risk of any operation at my age. I know it has been done thousands of times at this point and is pretty much perfected, but it is still surgery, and there are steps that have to be taken beforehand, including several sessions of electrolysis to remove hair and also an orchiectomy to remove the testicles. It is also a matter of total personal choice. Only about 30% of trans women have any type of surgery, either because of the expense or because they don't feel it is necessary for their own authenticity. So why even consider it? Because it's just a penis. It has no special gifts or use for me other than what I have said before. The ability to take a whiz in the woods. I just want to have all the right parts. I am also tired of tucking the damn thing in all the time. But I hate the thought of going under general anesthesia. I am also not a young person anymore. So over the past 18 months, I have gone back and forth. I lean toward having it done, and then I hesitate. There is something about the moon tonight that is taking me in 1,000 directions. Maybe because it's the residual of the harvest moon that took place the night before, a glow, an orb all its own. I think of my dad and what he would have thought of it all. I think of my mom, now 90 years old, whose acceptance of me and determination to learn about the issues puts to shame every parent who refuses to understand the pain of a child growing up in the wrong gender. I think of my brother, Bert, hovering above us, not quite believing that he now has another big sister in the family, and no doubt chuckling to himself. I think of friends I have not thanked enough. I think of my children and how I can only give them the one thing any of us can truly give, which is love. I think of successes. I think of failures. I think of Bruce. It is only in becoming Caitlin that I have realized he was a good man. The moon rises slowly and pivots over the mountains. Its glow is hypnotic. We all look on in the silence of wonder, because there still is wonder in the world for all of us. You never know what will happen. You just never do. Wait. I knew I forgot something. After much deliberation, I had the final surgery in November 2016. The surgery was a success, and I feel not only wonderful but liberated. I am telling you because I believe in candor. So all of you can stop staring. You want to know, so now you know. Which is why this is the first time and the last time I will ever speak of it again. This has been a Hachette Audio production of The Secrets of My Life, written by Caitlin Jenner with Buzz Bissinger, read by Aaron Bennett, with a special introduction by Caitlin Jenner. Produced and directed by Dennis Kao. Executive producer, Lisa Kahn. Sound editing by Sean Bolter. Mixing and mastering by Jeremy Wesley. The Secrets of My Life is also available in print and digital formats from Grand Central Publishing, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2017 by CJ Memories, LLC. Audio production copyright 2017, Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this book without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the book, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions at hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.